The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Hello, and welcome to the recordings of the 2016 ACOI Internal Medicine Board Review course. The course was held March 30th through April 3rd, 2016 at the Renaissance Resort at SeaWorld in Orlando, Florida. It features nationally known speakers covering topics of interest to the physician preparing for initial certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Osteomyelitis, septic arthritis, Lyme arthritis, rheumatic fever, and AIDS arthritis is presented by Dr. Howard Feinberg.
You want to pay attention to which vaccines are acceptable in immunocompromised patients on therapy. Do not give your patients live virus vaccines. Remember that. That's a board question. And also you want to check on, even though I'm not covering hepatitis C in my infection part, you want to check on which drugs are acceptable and not acceptable in the face of hepatitis C with autoimmune diseases too. Those are board questions that showed up. All right, we're going to go at a little bit more relaxed pace than what I had to do before. And I promise I'll breathe in between sentences this time. We're going to cover some of the infectious diseases that that involve rheumatology. Again, I have nothing to disclose. We're going to start with osteomyelitis. Osteomyelitis is an inflammation of the bone caused by an infectious organism. You can have both hematogenous spread or contiguous spread. Contiguous spread would be the typical diabetic foot ulcer that spreads into the bone, causing an infected joint, infected bone, sometimes an infected prosthesis. Hematogenous spread, anybody who's bacteremic, where the infection takes hold in the bone or joint. The most common organisms for this are staph, by far, and staph and strep make up the vast majority of these infections, and those should be your targeted organisms anytime you have a bone infection. We can see polymicrobial infections in diabetic foot ulcers. You can also see polymicrobial infections in an immunocompromised host. Usually those are a premorbid event. Now, this one actually did show up on the boards. Sickle cell disease has a higher incidence of salmonella. The published number is 50%. That's what I was taught 30 years ago when I was in training. It's still what shows up in Harrison's. It's still what shows up in the rheumatology book. No one believes the number is that high. I've seen a lot of sickle cell disease. I've seen one case of salmonella. But you should remember that bug with sickle cell disease. Can also see gram negatives, TB. In HIV, there are some specific organisms to keep in mind, the other mycobacterial infections. Nocardia candida will sometimes show up in both bones and joints. With cancer patients, you also see a much wider array of organisms. And in the immunocompromised host, histoplasmosis, coccidio, blastomycosis, depending upon what area of the country you're in. I've just recently had a run of 3 coccidiomycosis infections. So keep those in mind also in your immunocompromised patients. Clinically, in acute bone infections, you may see fevers. They may have some tenderness or pain over the area. You may get some muscle spasm or muscle pain in the region. It may also be vague pain. Children tend to have a lot more symptoms than adults do. And these patients may really not have a lot of symptoms with their disease. In the chronic form, night sweats, part of your differential TB, not just bone and joint TB, malignancies, especially the lymphoproliferative disorders, osteomyelitis, other autoimmune diseases all cause night sweats. You may see low-grade fevers, not necessarily high spiking fevers. Sometimes constitutional symptoms, weight loss, fatigue. If you're lucky, a draining sinus that you can culture. Sometimes tenderness or pain over the area. With TB, if we're talking bone and joint infections, the weight-bearing joints are the most common. For TB, bone infections. There's a specific form, Pott's disease, TB of the spine, where you can get a disc infection that can then infect the bone on either side and cause spinal fusion and vertebral collapse, and sometimes spinal cord compression. You can also get tuberculous infections in other areas in the bone. Pott's disease was on the boards last year. Okay, so for lab, in an acute infection, you'll usually see markers of inflammation, an elevated SED rate, sometimes a high white blood cell count, positive cultures in up to 50%, but cultures really are not reliable in osteomyelitis. Blood cultures are not reliable. You can get it in cultures of the bone, and that is the, ultimate diagnosis of doing a bone biopsy, getting a culture. You can see other phase reactants go up. Sometimes you can get it in urine cultures, but it can be hard to identify. For chronic forms, you may see an elevated SED rate. The markers of inflammation may not be that high. You have a 60 or 70-year-old person with a sedimentation rate of 40. Is that an osteomyelitis, or is their SED rate up because of their age? So sometimes those numbers can be confusing. Their white blood cell count may be normal. The cultures are often negative. You can still get a biopsy-positive culture in a lot of these patients. The diagnosis clinically can be difficult to make if you don't have a draining sinus or an obvious source. On X-ray, it can also be difficult. Plain X-rays are generally not positive in osteomyelitis until late in the disease. So you won't see lytic lesions or typical holes in the bone from osteomyelitis showing up for at least 6 weeks. You may not see them for several months. Bone scan can be positive, but is not necessarily a specific finding. So you'll see inflammation in the bone. MRI is usually a better test where you can actually see damage occurring to the bone and see changes that would go along specifically with an osteomyelitis. Okay, this is the spine. This is the little ACR at the bottom means this is an official slide of the American College of Rheumatology. We're allowed to use those. This is a disc infection that then spread to the bone and caused spinal fusion, a typical finding that we see with osteomyelitis in that area. Okay, so for treatment, acutely, the current recommendation is IV antibiotics for 4 to 6 weeks. This will depend upon the host that you're dealing with and the organism that you're dealing with, but minimum of at least 4 weeks. For chronic infections that have not responded initially to antibiotics, there's surgical debridement, drainage of the area. You want to assess their the vascular function in that area, especially in diabetics. If there is a prosthesis, that has to be removed, and then possibly amputation. All right, for infected joints rather than infected bones, number one is gonococcal arthritis. Back when I was in training, that accounted for 90% of the infections. The numbers have fallen, but it still accounts for about 50% of all joint infections. It has the best prognosis also of all joint infections, usually a very curable problem. For non-gonococcal, number one is Staph aureus, number two, beta hemolytic strep, and they represent another 45% of infections. So GC, Staph, strep are 95% of the infections. After that comes gram-negatives, usually associated with a very poor prognosis. Polymicrobial sometimes occurs in diabetics, but also occurs in immunocompromised hosts. In the immunocompromised patients, that's usually a premorbid event. And fungal and atypical infections, less than 1%. And this usually occurs only in patients who are severely immunocompromised and usually in the process of dying. Polyarticular disease, gonococcal again is the most common. It can be a migratory arthritis or a polyarticular arthritis. Non-gonococcal polyarticular septic arthritis has a very poor prognosis, usually something we see in severely immunocompromised patients. This isn't something that typically happens. It'll occur with other rheumatic diseases. It'll occur in cancer patients. It'll occur in some of the intensive care unit patients who are in the process of dying, so very poor prognosis. This is a skin lesion from GC. You can actually get a positive PCR test or a positive culture from it. It looks like a very small bullae on the skin. It's about half the size of a pencil eraser for most patients, can occur anywhere, but it's a good clue clinically to get an answer on a septic arthritis patient. These patients also will have migratory joint problems, so they'll have one joint flare up and move to another joint. That's very unusual with a septic joint, but not unusual with GC. They can also have tendon involvement, bursa involvement, sometimes have fevers with it. The synovial fluid cultures are usually negative. You have to get an anaerobic culture, get it done immediately. Even then, cultures are not very good from joint fluid. You're more likely to get a positive result if you do a PCR test on the fluid, or if you do a urethral or vaginal swab and culture GC that way. Treatment should be based on local sensitivities. It used to be penicillin was still effective for these patients. Now most of the joint infections are penicillin resistant, just like most of the urethral vaginal infections, and ceftriaxone is the current drug of choice. All right, for non-gonococcal, what we see is about 50% are in the knee, about 15 to 20% in the hip, usually in younger patients rather than older ones, and then 10% in the shoulder, followed by wrist, ankle, elbow. So it's usually the larger joints and weight-bearing joints first, and then the smaller joints less commonly. And this is the typical picture: red, swollen, painful. Your differential is usually crystal deposition diseases or infection. On x-ray, you'll see bone loss and erosions and inflammatory changes and effusions. Outcome really depends upon the patient. With knee, the prognosis is much better. Most of them have a pretty good outcome. With GC, the prognosis is really good. Most of them have a good outcome. But there's still anywhere from 5 to 15% mortality rate, and that depends upon how many non-gonococcal patients you have and non-knee patients you have. Also, we see a lot of joint damage, so these need to be treated aggressively. The white blood cells inside the synovial fluid will eat away at the cartilage and cause damage, so you need to get them out. So for these patients, the recommended treatment is you aspirate the joint until it's dry completely, and you do that at least once a day until the infection is calmed down, or you have arthroscopic surgery and lavage the joint after a diagnosis is made. Typically, what we expect is a white blood cell count over 50,000 for an infection. And that was on the boards too. It'll come up in my next talk also. Under 50,000, you would expect it to be an inflammatory disease or another process. So that's our typical cutoff. And then polyarticular, much higher mortality rate, almost 1 in 4 with rheumatoid arthritis, 50%. Good prognosis would be a knee, early treatment. All right, rheumatic fever. This was back on the boards also. We still use the Jones criteria. The Jones criteria are divided up into major criteria and minor criteria. The major criteria: arthritis, carditis, choreiform movements, erythema marginatum, typical rash, and nodules. The minor criteria are that you have a history of a prior episode of acute rheumatic fever, because there is a high recurrence rate in the population, arthralgias, so pain but not swelling in the joints, fevers, a high SED rate, a high C-reactive protein, high white count, prolonged PR interval, plus you have to have evidence of a recent strep infection. So you want to do nasal swabs, throat cultures, find strep, or get an ASO titer, find that their titer has gone up and then is coming down, a sign of a recent infection. To have this disease, you have to have two major, one minor criteria, two major criteria, or one major and two minor criteria. Don't want to say that wrong. So there was one question on the boards from this. If you know the criteria, you'll get the question right. All right, Lyme disease. Lyme disease is now spreading. It was isolated really to the Northeast United States and certain areas in the Northwestern United States, a little patch in Indiana. The spirochete has mutated, and there's now two other spirochetes that are causing Lyme disease, and it's moving west from the Northeast coast, and it's moving east from, I'm sorry, did I say that wrong? It's moving east from the Northwest and west from the Northeast, so moving more towards the center of the United States and spreading to other areas. So those of you who haven't seen Lyme disease in your areas, there's a good chance that it will be getting to you. Kentucky, we had no cases of Lyme disease that were documented to be caused by an infection in Kentucky. In West Virginia, there were 7 2 years ago. In the last year, we've had our first documented cases of Lyme disease in the state of Kentucky. West Virginia's numbers have quadrupled. So we're seeing it move into areas where it wasn't before. It is the most common vector-borne disease in the United States. It accounts for 95% of all vector-borne diseases. It is carried by a tick called I. scapularis. I like the old name better, which is why it's in parentheses, I. damini. It just had a good ring to it. You have to have a couple of different animals around. You have to have white-footed mice, deer, and ticks in order to do it. There are a couple of other ticks now that have been shown to be carrying the Lyme spirochete. So again, even if you don't have I. scapularis in your area, we're now seeing it being carried in other ticks. It's divided into three stages. Notice there is no stage four chronic Lyme disease. I know there are centers now that are treating chronic Lyme disease. There is no real documented chronic Lyme disease. So stage one is early disease that presents with a flu-like symptom, colds and congestion, and maybe erythema migrans. Stage two is early disseminated disease where you can see the rash, a Borrelia lymphocytoma, migratory arthralgias where joint pain is moving from area to area but no true swelling, peripheral neuropathy, and then carditis, which can present with fluctuating AV nodal block. And then it can move to stage three, if still not treated, where you can get acrodermatitis, chronic atrophicans, intermittent oligoarthritis, where you actually see joint swelling, encephalitis, and sensorimotor neuropathies. So the treatments for it vary depending upon the stage. And this is the finger there is pointing to the tick. It's a really tiny tick. The other slide is the typical rash, erythema, migrans. Lyme is a clinical diagnosis. The lab is not reliable. There are patients who have negative laboratory studies who have Lyme disease. There are a lot of patients with positive laboratory studies and confirmatory tests who do not have Lyme disease. So you have to make the diagnosis clinically or to the lab to help convince yourself that you're really right. If you suspect stage three neurologic involvement, the CNS test is fairly accurate, and you can confirm the diagnosis that way. Okay, for treatment, if they just have a tick bite, you give them 200 milligrams of doxycycline, and you're done if you're in an endemic area. So if you live in Old Lyme, Connecticut, use a lot of deep-containing spray, roll up the windows in your car, but if you get bitten by a tick, 200 milligrams of doxycycline. For early disease, so flu-like symptoms and a rash, 21 days of oral doxycycline. The backup drug would be amoxicillin. A backup to that would be ceftriaxone, rarely used unless you can't take anything else. If they have neurologic involvement, 28 days of ceftriaxone. Arthritis, 30 days of doxycycline or ceftriaxone. Cardiac involvement, 21 days of ceftriaxone. Again, no chronic long-term treatment. There are not documented cases so far of chronic Lyme disease. All right, and then AIDS-related arthritis. So with an initial infection, we can see arthralgias. Sometimes cold and flu-type symptoms go along with that. With an immunocompromised patient because of HIV/AIDS, we see infectious arthritis. You can see a pattern typical of what's now reactive arthritis, used to be Reiter's. We also see psoriatic arthritis, Sjogren's syndrome occurring in these populations. So again, all of those should be reasons to at least think about, could your patient have HIV? Spondyloarthropathies that my colleague talked about earlier. And then there's a specific AIDS-associated arthritis where you can get joint swelling because of high titers of the HIV and a higher risk of avascular necrosis and myositis. Okay, and I'm gonna move on to my bonus talk, which is osteoporosis. Osteoporosis is the number one metabolic bone disease in the United States and actually worldwide. It is a common cause of death. Let me repeat that. It's a common cause of death. It's a serious disease. It's something that's overlooked all the time. The diagnosis is missed all of the time. All right, for this talk, again, I have nothing to disclose, no known conflicts of interest. I did have an active osteoporosis research program back in the late 80s, early 90s, but I'm no longer doing work in that field right now. So nothing, no conflicts that I know about. The numbers for osteoporosis really haven't changed since I was doing that work. It We see low bone mass in about 44 million Americans, 80% of them women. Again, those numbers have not changed through three national census reports. About 1.5 million fractures per year. There are 10 million people with established osteoporosis, another 34 million with low bone mass that require therapy. The lifetime risk for a man, about 1 out of 3. The lifetime risk for a woman, about 40%. The death rate from osteoporosis has just recently, this past year, surpassed the death rate from breast cancer. So it is a more common cause of death in adult women now than breast cancer is. These numbers also have not changed in almost 30 years. About 700,000 spinal fractures, 300,000 hip fractures, 250,000 wrist fractures, another 350,000 other fractures. That comes out to 1.5 million fractures per year. If you add up all of the other common problems that would affect this same population, they don't equal the number of osteoporotic fractures. But despite that, we still see patients come into the hospital with a hip fracture and go home without treatment for osteoporosis, get bent over from spinal fractures and not get treated for osteoporosis. And we know that both of those problems carry a higher mortality rate for our patients. There are risk factors for osteoporosis. Number one would be age and female sex. Those aren't modifiable. You can't change your age, and I guess you can change your sex, but it really doesn't affect whether your risk is there for osteoporosis or not. There are a couple of other non-modifiable risk factors. The risk factors are only important because there are separate indications for treatment based on those, and there are also modifiable risk factors. So low body weight increases your risk. It's one of the few times where being fat is good for you. I don't recommend that, by the way. A calcium deficient diet, bad for you. Vitamin D deficiency. Back in the 80s when we were doing testing, I actually just pulled my records recently because I'm considering starting a vitamin D research project. We tested 17,000 roughly people. We found 2 that were vitamin D deficient. One of those had known congenital rickets. Nowadays we're seeing vitamin D deficiency in between 25 and 50% of the adult population. So something has changed in our environment that's causing vitamin D deficiency. Very common. You should be testing for this regularly in your patients. Inadequate physical activity, tobacco use, alcohol use, long-term steroid use, all risk factors. All right, so if you have a broken bone, you have an 86% risk of another broken bone. So the first question you should ask in any of your patients who have a broken bone is, would it have happened if they were 15 years old and had the same injury? And if the answer is, well, I fell in my kitchen and broke my wrist, or I fell out of bed and had a proximal humeral fracture or hip fracture, the answer to that is no. They probably have osteoporosis and they need to be on treatment. 1 year risk is more than 1 in 4 if you don't identify these patients and treat them. Clinical presentation is usually asymptomatic, so you should be screening all of your patients. Any low trauma fracture, again, should ring alarms for you. Any loss of height in your patient population, an increase in the thoracic kyphosis, the elderly woman bent over, and anybody with back pain. And let me repeat that one once more. Anybody with back pain, especially any adults with back pain. The number one cause of back pain in the United States is not osteoarthritis, it's not disc disease, it's not spondyloarthropathies, it's actually osteoporosis. As much as I hate to admit this, the initial studies of that was done by a smart orthopedic surgeon. I think that's an oxymoron. sorry. But I guess there was one. He was probably a frustrated internist, I don't know. But what he did was, everybody who came into the office got every test known. They did a bone scan, they did a DEXA scan, they did x-rays, they did CTs, they did MRIs. And what they found was the highest incidence of positive testing was a DEXA scan showing osteoporosis. So they only treated that part of it. They ignored all the other positive findings. And what they found was 80% of the time the pain went away. So number one cause of back pain in the United States was shown to be osteoporosis. That study was repeated in a rheumatology office, an internal medicine office, and a family practice office with exactly the same results. So you should think first osteoporosis for patients who have back pain. Okay, for vertebral fractures, I used to joke about this. The little old lady from Florida whose hair was taller than she is trying to see over the steering wheel of her Cadillac driving down the road. But a couple of years ago, the data came out showing that spinal fractures not only cause loss of height, loss of mobility, loss of function, pain, but they increase the mortality rate. It's a fatal problem. So it needs to be taken seriously. Patients who have this have a decreased life expectancy, a high rate of refracture, and they need to be treated. It's missed a lot on x-rays. You order a chest x-ray for a patient looking for CHF, looking for pulmonary disease, looking for pneumonia. The compression fractures are not always read. I just repeated a study like that in my own institution where we told the radiologists, we're going to rescan every chest x-ray you look at looking for compression fractures. Please make sure that you report them. And what we found was that they missed more than a third of them still. So look at your chest x-rays, look at the spine, look for compression fractures. That's a deadly illness, and please treat it. A 50-year-old woman right now has a 2.8% lifetime risk of death as a result of a hip fracture. That number was the same as breast cancer last year's data. The data that came out 7 weeks ago is now showing that hip fractures actually have a slightly higher lifetime risk of death than breast cancers, 4 times higher than endometrial cancer. So this is not only the most common fatal illness that affects adult women, but one of the deadliest. If you have a hip fracture, the numbers have not changed again in over 30 years. 20% will die within a year. 75% will require assistance with activities of daily living. 20 to 25% will be in a nursing home the rest of their lives. It's a devastating problem to have. Okay. To diagnose it, you do a DEXA scan. The indications for a DEXA on Medicare. Estrogen deficiency, that means any woman who's postmenopausal, you have an indication. Vertebral abnormalities of any kind. You don't have to document a compression fracture, just say their vertebrae aren't normal. Parathyroid disease, long-term steroid use, assessment of therapy, and screening is okay every 2 years. You can bill it as screening. The National Osteoporosis Foundation recommends all women over the age of 65, all men over the age of 70 get a screening DEXA exam, younger if they have one or more risk factors. Remember, risk factors are women and age, postmenopausal. So they all qualify. And what I personally recommend is you start screening women about 5 years postmenopause. The incidence of osteoporosis there is 15%. So once it's more than 10% in your population, I think it's justified to screen. The 50% rate is just over the age of 65 for women, 72 for men, 50% rate of osteoporosis. This is what a DEXA scan looks like. If you're not familiar with them, you can ignore everything on there except for the T-score. That's how you diagnose it. Normal T-score is better than negative 1.0. Osteopenia, negative 1 to negative 2.4. Osteoporosis, negative 2.5 or worse. Severe osteoporosis, negative 2.5 with a fracture. The T-score is a statistical analysis of the risk of a fracture. It's not an actual measurement. You can still fracture even if your T-score doesn't fit into those ranges. So anybody who has an insufficiency fracture, a fracture that shouldn't have happened because of the amount of trauma, they have osteoporosis and they get treated. Treatment guidelines, if they're normal, appropriate calcium and vitamin D, weight-bearing exercise and monitoring. If they have osteopenia, you do a FRAX analysis, that's a fracture risk analysis, and use the 10-year fracture probability to decide whether they get treatment. Okay, so if their 10-year probability of a hip fracture is more than 3%, they get treated. If their 10-year probability of other fractures more than 20%, they get treated. You can get this on the internet. You can just do a search for FRAX analysis. You get a formula based on your country, assuming all of us are going to be using the United States. Plug in a couple numbers. All you have to know is what machine was used, what their bone mineral density in grams per centimeter squared is, whether or not they have rheumatoid arthritis, and the age of your patient. Okay, for treatment, number one is prevention. That means appropriate calcium and vitamin D for life, and weight-bearing exercises, proper education and nutrition, fall prevention, and then for treatment, we also have pain control, surgery, medications. Calcium, very important. The current recommendations are any postmenopausal woman gets 600 milligrams twice a day. Men under the age of 71, 500 BID. Over the age of 71, 600 BID. For drug or prescription drug therapy, the recommendation is you start with a bisphosphonate therapy. So that would be Actonel, Fosamax, Boniva, Reclast. They've all been shown to decrease the fracture rate equally. Estrogen kind of goes in and out of style. I have some more information on that afterwards that's just in your packets for you to look at. Evista, which is a SERM that's been shown to prevent osteoporosis and increase bone mineral density by about 1%. Calcitonin, which we do not recommend because it has not been shown to prevent hip fractures. And then for patients who cannot take a bisphosphonate, Prolia. For patients with severe osteoporosis, so a T-score of -5 or worse, or who are fracturing on a bisphosphonate, Forteo. Okay, the rest of the information that's in your packets is just information about the drugs for you to be able to peruse and review. Thank you. Okay, so I get to continue with synovial fluid analysis. This is the shortest of my talks. Switch to the other. Some of which I've already covered. Going the wrong way. So again, I have nothing to disclose. This stuff is on here because it will be on your boards. Even back when I did my rheumatology fellowship, we really weren't using group 1, 2, 3, and 4 in these numbers. There were 3 questions on the boards that asked about this. So I would remember this part for your board exam. Synovial fluid is classified based on appearance and white blood cells into group 1, which is non-inflammatory fluid. That would be osteoarthritic fluid, usually is clear to yellowish with a low white blood cell number. Group 2, inflammatory, that would be the rheumatoid arthritis fluid that my colleague was talking about before, where you'll see elevated white blood cell counts, but under 50,000. Septic, over 50,000, and hemorrhagic, it's got blood in it. Okay, I put down groups of diseases in there, but if you remember the basic principles, you'll get that right. So group 1 is going to be non-inflammatory, group 2, inflammatory diseases, group 3, infectious diseases, and group 4, trauma. And again, these are the qualities of each of them. Back in the good old days, we used to do mucin clots on all of our patients. You'd see good mucin clots in normal fluid and osteoarthritic fluid and bad mucin clots in rheumatoid arthritis patients and infectious patients. We don't really do that test a whole lot anymore. The white blood cells and the color are the main things that you're going to look at to divide them. So normal joint fluid is completely clear and colorless, has very few or zero white blood cells in it, and there's minimal amounts of fluid in the joint, about 2 mLs in an average knee. Group 1, osteoarthritic fluid. Typically, you're going to have small amounts of fluid, although sometimes the effusions can get large. The white blood cell count, again, is going to be low, 200 or less. Not unusual to see 0, to see 20, so fairly low numbers. The fluid will be clear or yellowish, but you'll be able to see through it. It'll look clear. Group 3, inflammatory fluid. You won't be able to see through the fluid anymore. The white count will be in the thousands. The fluid will typically be yellow. You'll see a different amount of fluid based on how much inflammation is going on in the joint, but sometimes quite large effusions. And then again, group 3, you're going to see a white count of over 50,000. This is infected joints. And group 4 would be hemorrhagic. You'll see blood in it. So this is what they look like. A on there is normal fluid. B is non-inflammatory fluid. C is our gout patient. And D would be hemorrhagic. And again, the crystals, this was on the boards. It's been on the boards almost every year. Negatively birefringent needle-shaped crystals are gout. Just as a reminder, please remember that. Get that question right. Make me proud of all of you. Here's some other things that you can see in synovial fluid when you're looking under a polarized microscope. These are actually two different things. They're also two different magnifications. They're actually both the same size. One is under low power, one under higher power. The one on the left is talcum powder, the one on the right are gout crystals, called a Maltese cross. So don't get fooled. If you have gloves that are still in use with talcum powder on them, you may see funky things like this. You can't really make a diagnosis based just on those. These are the calcium pyrophosphate crystals. Again, these are positively birefringent parallelogram shaped crystals. Again, was on the boards, remember those. That's why it's there twice. and then some other things you might see in joint fluid. So the big square flat things, they kind of look like sheets of mica. Those are cholesterol crystals. They're not a sign of hyperlipidemia or of elevated cholesterol. They're a sign of joint fluid that's been there for a long time. And you'll see these, they're flat, they're square with a little notch out of the corner of them. You can see through them, and they're just a sign of a long-term effusion in a joint, as opposed to lipid crystals, which can be a sign of hyperlipidemia, which is, let's see, on your right-hand side on the screen. And these will not fluoresce under polarized microscopy. This is what I mentioned before. This is calcium oxalate, was on the boards last time, so I have an extra slide of it this time. Under light microscopy, you may see some clear chunky stuff. You may see absolutely nothing. But if you do an alizarin red stain, you're gonna see lumps of red all through it, and that's staining for calcium. If you do a von Kossa black stain, you'll see lumps of black all through it. And these are steroid crystals. And this is after a joint injection. So I have some on one side that look like gout crystals. Those are the yellow ones. They're kind of needle-shaped. And on the other side, they look more parallelogram. Those are the blue ones over there. Look like calcium pyrophosphate crystals. Again, something that can fool you in joint fluid. So you don't want to look at joint fluid right after a joint injection with steroids. You may see what looks like crystals that really aren't, that are just steroids in there. And then ochronosis, you can see the brown precipitate in the synovial fluid, and that's a synovial biopsy showing it.